Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Chris Jackson. And Fred and I were just wondering why so many warning signs in life are ignored. It seems like it's a human condition where we see things on a daily basis, and if something bad happens, we would rewind and go back to those points in time. So yes, that should have triggered some action to prevent this disaster from occurring, but it often requires that disaster to occur for us to take those warning signs seriously, which is obviously redundant by then.
Yeah, well, you know, I live in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and there's mountain lions that roam around here, and various people have got, you know, like a doorbell that's motion sensor and it puts on a video, or they have game cams out, and we see almost weekly people are showing pictures of mountain lions walking right up on somebody's porch and walking down the street in front of your house or stuff like that. We're wired to deal with immediate threats. People can, you know, if unless the cat's better off than you are, that you will sense that danger and deal with it. But when it's a danger of not something that's going to eat you, you have to be trained to see the danger. You have to understand that it is actually a danger. And I think that's my rationale for why we can walk past a leaky pump, or let's say you're leaking oil in the driveway and you see it for 2-3 months, and then you say, oh, I probably should do something about that. You know, why don't we see the threats posed by technology or chemistry or physics as readily as we see a threat caused by a mountain lion stalking you?
I agree with you that when you see the threat in the very visible, and to be honest, a way that evolution has supported us to understand, like we have over millennia, we have evolved to the point where we are conditioned to be afraid of spiders and snakes, and obviously large felines, which with big teeth are naturally scary to us, and that scare that. The emotion of fear has an evolutionary purpose. It's we run or avoid situations which create fear. Now, I agree with you up until a point. I mean, we were just talking about Los Alamos, the laboratory, I believe, down in Southern California.
It's where, a national lab, I think, right?
Right. And for decades, they've had issues with safety as it relates to their radiation and nuclear experimentation. They have a criticality incident, for example. It's a horrible, horrible thing. It's where you get enough enough uranium into a single location, or enough plutonium into a single location, or if you've got enough plutonium, but then you lean over it, and that means that more neutrons are being bounced back towards the plutonium. Essentially, it sets up the conditions for criticality where there's been accident after accident where these criticality incidents have occurred, and if you're standing within a meter or two, it's a guaranteed horrible death. And more recently, when I say more recently, at least in the last decade, there's a scenario where a bunch of plutonium rods were put very close to each other, primarily to show off to visiting dignitaries or bosses or managers. But it almost triggered another criticality incident. It had these rods, and we're just looking at the photo right now. They just look like very basic bits of metal, nondescript. That's what plutonium looks like. But had one rolled over, or had one more piece of rod put next to it, it would have been a criticality incident. And a criticality incident means that there's enough going on in terms of decay of molecules to sustain a reaction. And that's where gamma radiation and all sorts of horrible stuff gets burst out and essentially kills you. And it doesn't have to be metal. There's a very famous incident in Japan where dissolved nuclear fuel was improperly poured into a sort of big container. And by the time they poured the last bucket in, there was enough fuel in there for it to cause a criticality incident. Another one, again, at Los Alamos, I believe, was where there was a similar scenario, but they turned on this the operator turned on a pump, which created like a little tornado, a centrifugal pattern inside. And so all the fuel went straight into the middle, which meant that as opposed to being uniformly distributed across the entire liquid, it was all in the middle, criticality incident, and the guy died. And so these are scenarios where just having material, lumps of metal put too close to each other will cause a horrific incident. Now you walk into a machine shop, the number of hard hat signs, the number of emergency stop buttons, the number of near miss registers that you need to go through for that environment to be considered safe and is quite high, as it probably should be. But what's happening at Los Alamos, where if you look at the number of reports, and they do tend to report these accidents, at least some of them, the number of issues that are occurring year in, year out is just staggering. In that incident we just talked about, Fred, as we read in the article, the entire safety staff for Los Alamos essentially resigned on the spot, saying, well, no one's listening to us. Here's another example. Off we go. There's incident after incident. So, for example, people failed the mandatory safety examination they need to take every year or what have you, and they're allowed to continue working. That's not how it works. There's just incident after incident. And if something bad does happen, I can't help but think that we would look back at what is happening right now and say, well, of course, there was the unmistakable warning sign. So why isn't anyone really taking this to the next level and having a look at the fundamental culture of this place?
What comes to my mind is the near me, there's I think it's a state highway. It's not a federal highway, so it doesn't have all the bells and whistles and not near as expensive as a federal road or a state a big fancy freeway. It used to be one lane in each direction, and there were so many head-on collisions over time that they made it two lanes in each direction so they could go faster. And then they put a barrier down the middle of it. And at one point, there was a variety of crossings that were not overpasses. And there still are. There's plenty of places where you can get on or off this road. People are going freeway speeds through a windy mountain road with limited visibility, and people are trying to merge onto the traffic or trying to slow down to turn off the road. And it's just been a routine set of sirens every week of car crashes. Well, a number of years ago, a woman was picking up or dropped off her kids at school and was making one of these turns and got killed. But her family was politically connected enough that they put in an overpass for that road. Right. And so if you can use that overpass versus making a left turn across the freeway, basically across this highway, it's the right thing to do. But it took until somebody died.
Right.
And so after somebody dies in one of these left turns, they put up more barriers. They put up a warning light or they put up something. Yet it's been known for 50 years that this is a dangerous road.
Right.
And it's just part of it is budget. Part of it is political. Part of it is we've got, 10 million miles of roads. Where do we put the stop signs? We only afford so many stop signs. It's that balance of safety consciousness. I mean, if we were really, really serious about safety, we wouldn't use cars. we just wouldn't. But we've gotten used to it. We don't see, unless you listen to the traffic report on a drive time radio, car accidents and burning cars and incidents are everyday events. They don't make the news, yet people die every day.
I was going to say, challenge you about the whole thing about if we're serious about safety, we wouldn't have cars, because I think people tend to think of safety as the absence of risk, and that's not the case. So, for example, you can parachute safely, but when we say parachute safely, that means that the risk associated with parachuting has been reduced to a level that for that particular scenario, in that context, or what you choose to do, it is good enough. Even the perfect, the perfect parachute landing or you know, environmental, just the perfect jump can still risk injury if you have that random down gush of wind or you lose a bit of air because someone cut underneath you.
Yeah, or your chute fails and they happen. And it's, I agree. The issue I run into is that we stop seeing the consequences of not driving well. And we also, in this country anyway, we don't teach people how to drive well.
Right.
They don't even, I mean, locally, when I was talking to a kid that was getting his driver's license, so do you have to do parallel parking? He goes, nope, no parallel parking. How about backing up, you know, in a straight line? Nope, we don't do that. What do you do? We drive around the block and they give me a license. Yeah, I only made right turns. I was good. I was like, oh my God. But part of it is the lack of visibility of the consequences and right. the risks that are actually present. And so people like get in a Tesla and say, oh, it's an autonomous vehicle. I just, you know, I can sit back and play cards or read my tablet or, you know, do Twitter or whatever. And they die. And it's, I think by being so desensitized to the risk doesn't change the risk. It's the same in manufacturing sites. You know, you're walking past a motor that's leaking or a pump that's failing, but you've seen it every day for 2 months and it's like, oh, you don't even see it anymore. I think there's this conscious ability, like in Los Alamos, we've been doing business like this. This is what we do. You know, we want to make a nice show. We're all experts. We trust ourselves, blah, blah, blah. But they're just blind to the risks that they're just not capable of seeing it at some point. And I think that's the cultural issue, is that we need to maintain the reinforcement that, hey, if you 16-year-old and you get in a speeding ticket, you should be just thrown out of the car for the next 2 years until you grow up, you know, basically. But no, dad pays the speeding ticket and you get back in the car and tear off.
I mean, it's hard for, I understand the whole idea of, you know, you speed, you think you can, it's very easy for our sometimes primitive human brains to bury the increased likelihood of you wrapping yourself around a tree.
Mm-hmm.
It's just hard to understand how that can happen in a laboratory like this, where, I mean, criticality incidents have happened, and that you can Google the results. There are terrifying pictures of the progression of poor old patients who have been exposed to this sort of radiation as their bodies just slowly dissolve in hospitals over sometimes a period of months.
Yeah.
It's a perplexing scenario.
Well, that's the next level. And I think we've talked about it, I believe, about the NASA, the O-ring thing. And part of it is that there's so many risks. Which ones do you pay attention to?
Mm-hmm.
You know, to the point where you become desensitized to all of them. And the cultural part is what plays a role. Is no, we need to pay attention to this. Like you mentioned, is somebody violates or doesn't pass the mandatory test, and you just, oh, that's right, you just need this waiver, you're fine. No, they don't get it. They're not seeing it anymore. And that's where the systems that we try to put in place, why that safety team basically quit, you know, mm-hmm. resigned in mass, is that it's a broken process where we're not reinforcing that, yes, there are real risks. You need to be conscious of them.
Mm-hmm. Once that disaster happens, we'll all be able to look back with 2020 hindsight and go, how was this allowed to happen? And to be fair, it's not every organization's like this.
No. I've run into some wonderful organizations that. So let's say you're going to see a client, and you drive into their parking lot, and all of the cars, hundreds of cars, are all backed into the parking spots. Like if you go to the grocery store, there's some cars are backed in. Most cars are, you know, they drive from one lane to the next one, so they're facing out. Or very rarely do you ever see a car that pulls into a parking spot by backing into it. Well, so that's been my experience with parking lots. Parking lot, it's kind of random. Mostly people nose into a parking spot. And I get to this client site and every single car is backed in.
Yep.
So what would you think? I haven't even gotten out of the car yet, and I'm already wondering about this place.
Well, I've heard the story before, so I'm trying to recall back to the first time I heard the story. What did I think? One option is that everyone's OCD, and that's part of the hiring process, filter out non-OCD types. But there's clearly some coordinated direction going on.
Yeah, and there were signs all through the parking lot too. So it was reinforced with signage. Yep. And so I asked about it at lunch, and my host said, and they did a safety briefing first thing in the meeting, you know, so here's the exit. And this is a chemical plant kind of place or petrochemicals. And so, yeah, they had wind socks outside and says, if you hear this kind of sound, you know, rah, 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 and go outside, look for the wind sock and go upwind, you know, kind of thing. And they're like, okay, that's good to know. I wouldn't have known which way to run. But it was just ingrained throughout their culture. And at one point, they were looking at their stats for days lost. Why do our employees get hurt and not come to work? What can we do about that? And they said, we're going to do driver training. We're going to teach our people how to drive well. And so they had classes. And if you were going to rent a car, you had to pass this advanced safe driving course. It was like a week long on a track and with expert drivers to teach you how to drive in a very intensive way. And the host was like, you couldn't rent a car unless you passed that course. And not everybody passes it. You actually have to be very diligent about what you're doing and learn it. And they were very good at teaching people. But it was a tough course. And he said, I've taught my wife everything I could about it. I've taught, you know, he says, it's changed my life. I feel so much more confident when I'm on the road and cautious and safer. And one of the things they found was a simple thing as backing into a parking spot reduces pedestrian car accidents. You have limited visibility when you're backing out. Mm-hmm. And if you just reverse that process, you drive past a parking spot, you say, all right, that's open, I can get into it. Very few people walk between the cars in an open spot versus walking down the lane to their car or from their car. And so just statistically, it cut the probability of somebody getting hit in a parking lot by a car to near zero from whatever it was before. And it was significant enough that they reinforced it. They spent a bunch of money on it, trained everybody to do it, mandated it across the organization. That was just one piece of many, many things they did about car safety. And it created, it was something like a 10% increase or a change in accidents related to out of office, you know, people being home recuperating because they reduced the number of auto accidents in their workforce.
Well, that's actually, I think that's the key. I mean, we talked at length, you and I have talked about, for example, the Hewlett-Packard 10X Reliability Project, mm-hmm. and how they wanted to focus on reducing essentially the number of warranty failures.
Right.
They reduced it dramatically over a 10-year period.
But they paid attention to it every meeting, every discussion. It was monitored and tracked on a weekly basis. It was recorded and tabulated and discussed and prioritized and...
But what else did they benefit from? They also reduced time to market. Now, not everyone gets that. Yep. We don't do a reliability improvement. We're not going to improve time to market. We'll do the time to market initiative once we've done this one. No, they're able to reduce time to market by 30% in some cases. They're able to reduce the recommended retail price by up to 20% in some cases. They're able to reduce stock holding by, I think, $200 million, I believe, in the first 3 years. And so what that... They just knew that there was this whole suite of benefits just waiting, and they actually valued those benefits. And so for the safety initiative you're talking about at that place you're working for, where they're reversing their cars in, it wasn't just, you know, people not getting hurt. That's very important. But what's the follow on benefits? We have fewer days off. We have
fewer medical bills, or insurance bills for the medicine, you know, medical bills, medical insurance. Yeah, it made difference to the bottom line of that organization.
Right. And that whole week-long training thing, that is management dedication. That's not them saying, hey, if you got spare time in the future and you're on your weekends, go and do this. That'd be really good. No, it's that we will pay someone to come in here. We'll give you a salary to go do it for a week. That is a big impost. That just tells the employees that, hey, this is something this organization takes seriously, and that's what you need. So there's so many follow-on additional, let's call them second order or periphery benefits you get when you try to improve reliability or try to improve safety. And the organizations that do it well are forensically aware of what those benefits are. It's those organizations who aren't, who don't see the value in it, even if they say they do on posters when you walk past the walk in the main entrance. Those are the organizations who invariably look for shortcuts, try to downsize a safety budget, and for some magic reason have incident after incident after incident. It's just it should be no surprises there. And these are the organizations that when something, it requires a disaster to occur, and then in hindsight everyone goes, well, no wonder this thing occurred. You were doing all these things that were very clearly obvious to anyone who cared to look at it. Why didn't someone shut this down now?
Yeah.
To an extent, the laboratory, I believe, has not been allowed to do certain things until it gets its safety safety rating high enough to do it. But this has been going on for the best part of a decade. So at what stage do we go, you know what? We need a fundamental change in what's going on here. We can't just ask the same people that got us in this situation to try and get themselves out of it. They're clearly not super interested.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm talking about any organization here, but it's hard to arrive at any other conclusion besides that when we look at the example we've just been talking about.
Yeah. You know, from a safety or reliability part, it's really, I think we touched on one of the key things. It has to have a tangible benefit to the organization, the stakeholders, essentially. And if there's not that feedback mechanism, if there's not that recognition, it's a cultural thing, then you got a problem. But if the idea of reducing medical insurance premiums is important to an organization, then connecting the improvement suggestions to that goal makes more sense. That if we teach our people how to drive safely, we can reduce days lost due to accidents or medical leave kind of thing. So the same for reliability. If we want to improve reliability, if we can simply reduce warranty, that's enough to pay for it. But we also improve all these other things, and I think that's a big part of connecting what we do, whether it's safety or maintenance or reliability design, is it has to add value. It has to make sense. And oftentimes it does. It just has to connect the dots to make that work. But it's really, really hard to fight a culture, an organization that says, no, that's not important. We're not going to do that. If they just ignore that connection or benefit or value, then it's time to go find, like, that safety group. It's like, well, we're not useful here. We'll go somewhere else.
Yeah. It is built into the DNA of how people interact with each other. I think it's actually a pretty binary thing. Organizations either do take it seriously and reap the rewards, or they don't, and complain that there are no rewards to reap.
Yeah. And I think the people, the cultures that just don't see the benefits are desensitized to it. They just don't see it. They haven't sat down and thought it through. And there's so many other things to think about, that like profit this quarter, that I'm not worried about that. You know, we got to make more widgets. How do we increase productivity? How do we, get more for less? And all those priorities. So anyway, if you're listening to this, if this rings a bell, and hopefully you're not in one of these cultures where safety is really just a waiting for the disaster to happen and then nothing changes, what works for you? How is the culture going, and what made the difference that it made it good versus not so good? join the conversation, head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. We have a SpeakPipe widget there that allows you to leave us a voice message through your browser. You can also type us a comment or message there. You can also find Chris or I or the other hosts of the show on LinkedIn or on our About pages on Ascendo. So there's lots of ways for you to join the conversation. I've almost got that closing refrain. I should record it maybe, although...
Maybe.
Yeah.
Just have a button that you push every time you want it to be inserted into the...
Well, then I'll forget it's there and I'll just, it'll sound the same every time. No,
I see. You know,
this is part of the culture. I actually do want people to join us, and we do get comments and feedback every week. And, mm-hmm. you know, if we appreciate the ones that say, hey, nice, you know, good show or, you know, good topic or whatever. But if I'm encouraging everybody to do is to leave us their questions or their stories. We'd love to incorporate your comments, your input into the conversation. So that's what I'm really after. I want to make it genuine, you know.
Mm-hmm. Make people know that you care.
That's right. I do care. And anyway, we do care. We have good sound system. We, at least we try, you know.
Stuff yep. like that.
So anyway, Chris, we'll see what mischief we can get up to today. And we'll go forward with that. We'll get this one all packaged up and sent out in a couple of weeks and we'll be all set.
Absolutely. Well, good chatting to your friend and look forward to talking soon.
All right. Take care, Chris. Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.